Good afternoon, everyone. Again, my name is Prakash Mulay, and I work with Florida Department of Health on mostly chemical-related disease surveillance, and pesticide is one of the big one for us. So this whole sulfur fluoride started with an incident in Florida, and we investigated a poisoning in a household. So that happened last year in August, and since then I've been learning a lot about this chemical, and I just want to share with everyone what we learned. So on August 19, we learned about a family who was sick after a house fumigation. And the fumigation was conducted with sulfur fluoride, which is mainly used for termites and rodents and stuff like that. And the chloropicrin is added just as a warning agent. So we learned from Poison Control Center that son, daughter, and mother, and grandmother, they went to emergency department. Simultaneously, we also learned from the hospital that they have received a pesticide poisoning cases. So, and especially the one 9-year-old son who was seriously affected in that incident. So just to give you a background, what is house fumigation? So what they do is like they cover the house, which need to be treated with a tarp or a tent, and they inject gas, sulfur fluoride, and they also add a chloropicrin just as a warning agent in case somebody gets in or the gas leaks out. And they treat that facility for a certain period of time, from 2 hours to 72 hours. And once that's been, the treatment is done, they take off the tarp and they air the facility to get the gas out. And the pest control operators need to measure the levels of sulfur fluoride at the end of the treatment. So, and by EPA requirement is the level need to be below 1 parts per million to allow people to enter into the facility. So the pest control contractors, they have a measuring device and they usually go and measure like once or twice just to make sure that the levels are below the required level of 1 parts per million. And they usually put out the postings all around the facility just to keep everyone out. And also the chloropicrin is there to warn if gas leaks out or something like that happens. So just to give background, the pesticide-related illness and injury is a reportable condition, and we participate in sensor program, we collect data and share with NIOSH. So all due to reporting requirement, we collect and investigate all reports of pesticide-related illness and injury. And we also work with other agencies like Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, Poison Control Center, and so all these two agencies were involved during this investigation. So what we learned after initial notification, we worked with our county health departments to collect medical records and follow up and conduct interviews. And we learned that the 9-year-old son who was seriously injured was hospitalized for about 19 days. He had serious tremor, movement disorder, and speech disorders. And that all started, and he was hospitalized for 19 days and for basal ganglia injury, and then he was sent to a rehabilitation center for another 20 days. And the other three family members, grandmother, mother, and daughter, they were treated and released the same day, and they were diagnosed with chemical inhalation. And they all developed nausea and vomiting, and I think I'll talk about that a little further. The father, only father, was interviewed, and he didn't seek any medical help. But he was interviewed on the day, and later they decided not to talk to us, so we didn't learn much about the story, but we were able to get the initial information from father, what happened and all that. So going back, the sulfur fluoride product they used is called Zythor, and it is 99.3% sulfur fluoride. And this is not the common product widely used. So there's another one widely used is called Vicane. And so initially we thought it's a Vicane, but then when Department of Ag started the investigation, they found out this is the Zythor. And there are two more other products in the market which contains sulfur fluoride. So just to give background before I go into the violations, so what happened on August 14, which is the pest control contractors, they started the fumigation of the house. And they conducted fumigation for 48 hours. They aired the house, they measured the levels, they cleared the building, and the family were allowed to get into the house 2 days later on August 16. And the same day, the evening, the son started having nausea and vomiting, which is a very common symptom of sulfur fluoride poisoning. And throughout the night, by next day, 6 a.m., all other family members started having nausea and vomiting and headache. And by that time, the son was really lethargic. He was having tremors and movement disorders on both sides of his hands and legs, and he was having difficulty speaking. So they decided to go and see into the emergency department, and they were seen by a physician, and the son was admitted into the pediatric ICU, and he was poison control center was consulted at that time, and that's how we have real-time access to their data, and that's how we learn in the beginning. And as soon as we learn about the incident, we started following up. And we also informed Department of Agriculture, and they followed up with the company, and they did their investigation. They found several violations with this company, and recently we learned that this company they had a judgment in the court, and the pest control contractor and the owner of the company, they had 2 years of imprisonment so for the criminal investigation. So that just came out like 2 or 3 weeks ago. And so what Department of Ag did immediately after knowing, they collected all the information, they did the investigation, they found that this company said they measured the sulfur fluoride level at the end of the treatment, but the device they were using was not calibrated, it's not in working condition. So that's of no use, and that's the first big violation they found. And this company did not participate in manufacturer's training and stewardship program and for a long time, so they were not up. Go ahead.
Can I ask you, what is the distinction between a stewardship plan
I think I'm not, maybe someone can jump in, but the way I learned that the pest control contractors need to take training every year, and they have some training programs to keep up with the, and these are Zythor and Viken has separate stewardship plans, and they have to participate. So I'm not really sure what's the distinction. But it's more like ongoing phone calls, seminars, kind of stuff. Like just they have to keep up with the most recent knowledge, what they have. And Jeff, do you know anything about stewardship?
Yeah, you know, these are, I think it's not unusual for a pesticide that's a restricted use pesticide, which are the most toxic pesticides, that they have these stewardship programs because they're so toxic. People need to clearly understand how to use it, and so one way to make sure that they clearly understand how to use it is to make them go through these stewardship programs, so they're doing like continuing education
right
every year or two.
So it's more frequent education they have to go through and keep up with all that, what company has changes, and like keep up with that knowledge. Yeah, thank you. And again, as Jeff mentioned, this is a category one chemical, so it's very toxic. Yeah, and there were several other violations like that were identified. Like this company did not provide correct information about how they did the treatment in the beginning. So they lied about a few things in the beginning, and that, like the storage of the chemicals, they store in one place. They say like we store in this place, but actually the DAX investigator found that they store in different place and not in proper condition. So there were several violations like that. And immediately after the investigation on September 29, within a month or month and a half, they canceled the license for this company, which is the highest level of punishment they can give to a company. pest control company, and then so. So it, at the Department of Health, what we did, we worked with our medical epidemiologist, and we have a toxicologist. So we worked with them, and we looked at medical records and the toxicology profile of this chemical, and we made a determination that the illnesses we saw in these four individuals is most likely related to sulfur chloride, and we shared that determination with the Department of Agriculture, which helped them to take further action. So based on the NIOSH case classification, we classified father as a probable case and all other four family members as a confirmed case of sulfur fluoride related illness and injury. And only son had severe illness, and all of the family members had low severity of illness. So just before they canceled the license on September 15th, we shared all our findings with Department of Agriculture in a report, and that report is publicly available if somebody wanted to look at. And we provided our determination, which actually helped them to take action against the company. After that, the Ag Commissioner got interested in this case, and they actually followed, they requested more data on sulfur fluoride poisonings in the state. And they said, like, please give us what you know about sulfur fluoride poisonings and share your data. And we don't have a lot of cases, since the case definition is very strict, like two or more related symptoms. And so we didn't we only had like about 15 cases over a 10-year period of time. Over five years period of time, because they only asked us give us 5 years of data. So we decided to look at our poison control center data and see like what's the burden of sulfur fluoride poisoning in the state. So we looked at we looked at that data, and I'm going to present that in the next few slides. So we prepared a summary of our poison control center data and shared with them, which later went into their larger report that they produced on structural fumigation regulations and processes. And with that report, they requested more statutory authority to conduct more, to have more inspectors and some more authority to conduct inspection and investigations of the facilities with structural fumigations. So now onwards, I'm going to talk about the data we got from Poison Control Center related to sulfur fluoride, and we looked at 5 years of data from 2010 to 2015. And if somebody is new at the Poison Control Center data, it's all Poison Control Centers are run by American Association of Poison Control Centers, and it covers all states. Some states have more than one Poison Control Centers, and some Poison Control covers more than one state. So it's national. They have standard way of collecting data, and it's been categorized based on national poison data system. And Florida has three poison control centers. One is in Miami, Jacksonville, and Tampa, and we get data from all these three centers. And most of these calls are handled by licensed by physician, nurses, and pharmacists. So they are very well trained professionals who actually provide consultation on how to treat poisonings, and they collect data at the same time. So we thought it's useful to look that data for this purpose. So from January 1st, 2010 to October 31st, 2015, we had about 166 calls, on average 28 calls per year. And the age ranged from less than 1 year to 84 years. The mean was 30 years. And our highest counties were Miami-Dade, which is big in population, and I think that's why the numbers were high. So Miami-Dade, Broward, Palm Beach, Pinellas, and Hillsborough, and all these are larger counties by population in Florida. we look at the trend by year and the quarter of the year, and as you can see, during 2013, 14, and 15, we see increase in exposure calls related to sulfur fluoride during third quarter of the year. So that's something we thought is important, because then we can target the outreach just before the beginning of the third quarter. Usually, poison control center data is kind of biased towards the pediatric age group, because this lot of people call poison control. If it's a child, they want to call immediately, and so their data is kind of biased towards pediatric. But when we looked at sulfur fluoride specifically, we see increase in the number of calls within 25 to 49, which is mostly adults. So looks like most of the adults, they actually have called poison control centers for sulfur fluoride poisoning. And females were slightly higher than males for the calls. And there were calls which reported more than one exposure to more than one substance, and most of our the calls, about 93.4%, were related to just fumigant, which is sulfur fluoride, and some were related to the fumigants and lacrimator, which is chloropicrin. So, and there were a few other, like three other calls, which related to other substances in addition to the sulfur fluoride. Most of the calls were related to unintentional, but there were 9 calls related to intentional exposure. And intentional exposures are mainly somebody's trying to get into the building to take the pet, like they have some pet which went into the building, and they just want to rescue the pet, and they just ran into the house and take it out. So those kind of like intentional and kind of injuries. Okay, so most of these were in the residential facilities, some were in school, and even vehicles and boats are treated by sulfur fluoride. So we saw 3 were related to vehicles, and 12 were related to workplace injury. And by management side, most were managed on site. So later we'll see this, most of the people had mild kind of injury. But there was, and okay. So 41% reported signs and symptoms. 18% said they didn't have any signs or symptoms after exposure. And for 41%, we don't know whether they experienced any symptoms, signs and symptoms or not, because sometimes they call and then poison control centers couldn't follow up with them, so they couldn't collect additional information. And as far as medical outcome, and this is a very important for us to look at, because we observe most of the cases exposure calls had minor illnesses, about 21%. About 6% had moderate. Only 1 had major illness, and that's the case of 9-year-old son, which we just saw. And there was another call which reported death of a person. And we looked further into that, and this is a homeless person which entered into a house which was under treatment, and they found her dead in the morning. So that's the case, and we don't know much about that case. And so we looked at the signs and symptoms, and we categorized them based on the organ system, and we found most of the people experienced GI followed by neurological and respiratory and ocular symptoms. So, and there were 6 people who actually reported cardiovascular. And we looked at the toxicology of this sulfur fluoride, and basically, most of the people have the irritation of upper respiratory tract, skin, eyes, and same like chloropicrin. But serious poisonings may have leads to the fluids in their lungs, breathlessness, and the fluoride ions actually binds with the actually have effect on heart. So people have reported myocardial infarctions and like death from the heart failure. So after that incident, we worked with the sensor program and Dr. Jackson is our medical toxicologist, medical epidemiologist, and Gretel Clark, she is with our county health department, and Jeff, and we wrote notes from the field based on this incident, and we submitted to MMWR. So it's now accepted, and it's going to be published next month. So with that, we we talked to our other sensor states, and especially California. They are also interested in house fumigants and looking at sulfur fluoride. So we decided to do an article looking at different data sets and nationally, and see what's the burden of this poisoning nationally. And we started with the sensor data, and then we included California Department of Pesticide Regulations data, and we also requested our national poison data system from the Poison Control Center. So they also shared their data on sulfur fluoride with us just for this article, so which is really great for us to have that. So currently we are looking at all these three data sets, and currently we are in a stage of cleaning data and just doing that preliminary analysis. And so once we have that done, we are planning to publish that in a peer-reviewed journal, so that we can highlight the importance of this sulfur fluoride poisoning. So in conclusion for this presentation, we think the sulfur fluoride poisonings based on the Florida Poison Information Center data results into low severity of illness on most of the times, but there have been high severity of illness and deaths reported. And mostly those are related to the label violations or not following like training and stewardship plans, and not doing the job correctly. So the label, not following the label, and is a big thing. So if there are any violations, I think that puts people at higher risk. But usually the people report low severity of illness. And we also want other jurisdictions to look at their own system and see if they have seen similar incidents, and if they want to talk to their agriculture and regulatory authorities to improve those conditions for homeowners. And another component of this, we think, is educating homeowners is very important, since there are alternative methods available to treat termites and other pests, and this shouldn't go house fumigation as the first choice. So I think there should be a lot of education that need to be happen at that level. And this is my contact information if you have need more information about the reports we produce. And if there are any questions, I'm happy to take it now. Yeah. So here I basically highlighted the two important ones. There were seven different violations that were identified. But these were the important ones, like not having functioning device to measure sulfur fluoride concentration. And the second one was not participating in training and stewardship plan.
Do you think that there were still dangerous levels of fluid in the air, and even though they ventilated and everything?
Sort of right. So I mean, there is no way to confirm now, because there were no measures taken later to see, because by the time the Department of Ag went there and they started investigation, it was like a few days already passed. But what company reported is like they did air the building and they did measure, but the device was not functioning and not calibrated, so we really don't know what the actual levels were. They're supposed to take two measurements at least, and the measurement should fall below 1 parts per million to clear the building, which they did. But since the device was not working, it doesn't really matter to me.
So the family came back and they were probably
injured. Right.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, they do. And I don't know much details since I work with the Department of Health, but they do have a really good plans and processes in place. And this is what I want to highlight. Like, there are plans and processes in place. It's just the people need to understand that they're important, and they need to follow on all those, especially pest control contractors. Yeah. And I'm happy to get in touch with our people so that you can explore more on those, what they are. And
we recently had a case in Orange County. We have Orange County. Where they had, with a family, and they were having illness. So nothing as severe as that one boy, but I think they tried to go back to the house again, and they still had symptoms, so they officially gave up, and they went back into the bedroom, and they pushed down a cushion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's another important point we've been hearing, is like off-gassing of the sulfur fluoride and chlorpicrine after measurement, like from the furniture, from the papers, the closets, they are closed, and attics, like when they open, like maybe like that the gas comes out, and the measurements where they take is in the bigger rooms where maybe the levels are low, but when the family enters and they start using the facility, they might. So those are another, yeah, I mean, we've been hearing, but there's more study need to be done to be sure that that's what's happening. And I just want to point out the 9-year-old son with the basal ganglia injury is the first case reported in a whole literature that actually happened with sulfur fluoride and basal ganglia injury. There have been studies which showed sulfur fluoride linked to basal ganglia injuries in animals, but this is the first time we've seen. Usually people with high levels of sulfur fluoride exposure, they die. I mean, they don't survive. But in this case, this person survived, and this is a unique case in itself. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Okay, so did I understand correctly that where it says revoked license, had it been revoked before they were operating? So they were currently, at this in time of this incident, they were operating without a license?
No, that's not true. So okay, the treatment, the house was fumigated in August, and we learned about the incident on August 19, and Department of Agriculture revoked license on September 29.
Okay, so that was, they revoked their license as a result of
this investment. Mm-hmm.
And did the family sue?
Yeah, they did, and that resulted into criminal investigation, and EPA stepped in, and they did their own investigation. The company and the owner, they plead guilty. They went ahead, and recently we learned that the decision was made on the case.
So, go ahead.
Okay.
So recently what I learned is like the boy's condition, in the beginning he was having difficulty in like slurred speech and choreographic movements on both arms and legs, like which is like tremors and body movements on both sides of and feet. So that was his initial condition, but after rehabilitation it improved to the level, his speech was improved, he was able to communicate and order in a restaurant and smile and all that. So recently I learned that he's still having the problems. It just like it's a little better than what he had, but talking to some of the colleagues, like the prognosis is unknown for this child but he's still small and he has a lot to grow, so he might be better, but the prognosis is unknown since the basal injury.
Web portal that you must upload your clearance monitoring data in the hopes of making some bad actors better actors and compliant. I have a little bit of a problem saying in a recommendation to educate the public. I don't think that's an effective strategy.
It's in our state, that would be tricky because what the applicators are supposed to do is sell that in the law. And you have to go through a legislative change to have it revised.
So I see a research fundable project here that could happen in more than one state in order to get to the educational effort that you were talking about. One is there could be an opportunity for an impartial measurer to go in separate from the licensed applicator to do measurements, also then to go into closet spaces to do measurements, to do test measurements about what's off-gassing from bedding or other things. As a research thing, where are the residues hidden and what are those levels of residue? And then turn that into education that would probably be for any tenable home that gets fumigated like that, that gives the family a checklist, not only if you smell something or if you feel something, get the hell out, but also make sure that, you open windows just as a precaution, but to be aware that residue could be in cushions and bedding and your clothing or some whatever the research shows you, and it may even be that you want to take those clothing out of there. I don't know. But it seems like that research could be the foundation of some education that then the applicator, before they do the application, would have to give them this easy-to-read brochure with lots of drawings and pictures in a language they understand at a level they can understand it, so they can be a little bit better empowered to protect themselves.
That's really good thought, yeah. What I know is like I'm not familiar with all the laws and regulations in place, but what I know, there are several of them. The serious high severity illness and deaths occurs if they are not followed. So it's more like training, and people need to understand they're important to follow. That's the main key to prevent those high severity and deaths related to sulfur fluoride. I recently learned that EPA has proposed a rule to improve trainings for pest control contractors, and I think that's still in draft, but I'm happy to share that the one which is on the website. So they already have proposed a plan on that. And one other thing I want to point out is over the years, like this is a replacement for methyl bromide house fumigation. And since methyl bromide has been phasing out, the use of sulfur fluoride is increasing. So more and more people are using. So that could be one issue that we're seeing more and more cases in the recent years.
So to prevent more and more cases,
right,
the research to measure what the hazard is or what the risk is, and then turn that into education that could exist, could go out in more than one state or more than one jurisdiction, could be a preventative measure. Not as good as getting the applicators to do the right thing, but at least empowering the homeowner, like you want to empower workers about their rights, empowering the homeowner to know what to recognize, what to look for, who to contact immediately, not only just go to the doctor, et cetera, but what their recourse is. It just seems like that would be a thing that here you're getting data from two jurisdictions that are compatible. This could lead to a potential prevention measure that could save. You're doing more than just counting how many people get sick. You're actually taking that, turning it into education that might prevent numbers of people from getting sick, or at least getting them to act quickly to prevent it from being severe illness.
So yesterday, Bob Harrison was talking about methylene chloride, but expressing all this outrage about, I think, 15 deaths in the last 50 years.
Oh, yeah.
So we've been kind of pulling all the data together for sulfur fluoride, and we're finding
I can talk a little bit more on
that.
So currently we looked at it's just preliminary results, so don't quote me on these things, but we're still looking into more into that. But recently we learned that EPA has 20 they have incident data system, and which they get it from the providers and manufacturers, and that data shows that there are 24 deaths of sulfur fluoride death, and that's one of the highest deaths they receive. We also looked at our Poison Control Center data. There are 4 fatalities reported in poison control nationally, and there are about 13 or 16 high severity of cases in the Poison Control Center data. And the higher numbers are in Florida, California, Hawaii. So these are the higher number states that we have seen so far. Does that cover?
Because of that, sulfur fluoride is on EPA's radar, so they're seems like they're putting a lot of attention into it. So we'll see what EPA comes up with.
But so we know that people don't like to live with termites, and they don't like to live with rodents. So something's, I mean, it's not just a matter of pulling things off. That may be the ultimate answer. We've got 20 preventable deaths and injured some unknown number of injuries like this. But in the meantime, it certainly seems like there are measures that can be taken. And even if this is taken off the market, something else is going to replace it. And you know, if it's not benign to those pests, it ain't going to be benign to us. So having some sort of empowerment tool for the occupants, and ain't nobody else going to come up with it other than you guys, because you're looking at it and you have the ability to do it.
Well, like you kind of said, there are not, I guess, lower toxicity ways to eradicate the termites.
Termite, yeah.
Like heat, you can like set your home and then generate high levels of heat.
Right, and you can freeze it.
Or you can freeze it.
But those have other repercussions. Heat melts other things, freezing cracks other things. I'm not saying that, you know, I probably prefer heat or freezing to in my house rather than having those residues. But in the meantime, there are people who aren't going to think about that and are going to use that.
Right.
So
we probably need to move on.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.